following the highway almost to Cleveland before turning back. He takes sleeping pills from the drugstore, and even in his dreams, Lydia is dead. Again and again, he finds only one place where he can stop thinking. Louisa's bed. He tells Marilyn that he's going into class, or to meet with students. On weekends, he says he has papers to grade. These are lies. The dean had canceled his summer class the week after Lydia's death.
"Take some time for yourself, James," he had said,
touching James gently on the shoulder. He did this with everyone he needed to soothe. Students enraged over low grades, faculty slighted by the grants they did not receive. His job was to make losses feel smaller. But the students never turned their C-minuses into Bs. New funding never materialized. You never got what you wanted. You just learned to get by without it. And the last thing James wants is time for himself. Being at home is unbearable. At every moment, he expects Lydia to appear in the doorway, or to hear the squeak of her floorboards overhead. One morning, he heard footsteps in her room, and before he could stop himself, he ran upstairs, breathless, only to find Marilyn pacing before Lydia's desk, opening and closing her desk drawers. "Get out!" he wanted to shout, as if this were a sacred space. Now, every morning, he picks up his briefcase, as if he is going to teach, and drives into the college. Even in his office, he finds himself mesmerized by the family photo on his desk, where Lydia, barely 15 then, peers out, ready to leap through the frame's glass and leave everyone behind. By afternoon, he finds himself at Louisa's apartment, plunging into her arms, then between her legs, where, blessedly, his mind shuts off. But after leaving Louisa's, he remembers again, and he is always angrier than before. On the way back to his car one evening, he seizes a stray bottle from the street and hurls it into the side of Louisa's building. Other nights, he fights the temptation to steer into a tree. Nath and Hannah try to stay out of his way, and he and Marilyn have barely exchanged a word in weeks. As the 4th of July approaches, James passes the lake and finds that someone has festooned the dock with bunting and red and white balloons. He swerves to the side of the road and rips it all down, bursting each balloon under his heel. When everything has sunk beneath the surface of the water and the dock lies solemn and barren, he heads home, still shaking. The sight of Nath rummaging in the refrigerator sets him ablaze again. "You're wasting power," James says. Nath shuts the door, and his quiet obedience only makes James angrier. "Do you always have to be in the way?" "Sorry," Nath says. He cups a hard-boiled egg in one hand, a paper napkin in the other. "I didn't expect you." Out of the car, with its lingering air of exhaust and engine grease, James realizes he can smell Louisa's perfume on his skin, musky and spicy sweet. He wonders if Nath can, too.
"What do you mean you didn't expect me?" he says. "Don't I have a right to come into my own kitchen after a hard day of work?"
He sets his bag down.
"Where's your mother?" "In Lydia's room?"
Nath pauses.
"She's been in there all day."
Under his son's eye, James feels a sharp prickle between his shoulder blades, as if Nath is blaming him.
"For your information," he says, "my summer course comes with a great deal of responsibility, and I have conferences, meetings."
His face flushes at the memory of that afternoon. Louisa kneeling before his chair, then slowly unzipping his fly, and this makes him angry. Nath stares, lips slightly pursed. as if he wants to frame a question but can't get past the w. And suddenly, James is furious. For as long as he has been a father, James has believed that Lydia looked like her mother, beautiful, blue-eyed, poised, and that Nath looked like him. Dark, hesitating in mid-speech, preparing to stumble over his own words. He forgets, most of the time, that Lydia and Nath resemble each other, too. Now, in Nath's face, James suddenly sees a flash of his daughter, wide-eyed and silent, and the pain of this makes him cruel.
"You're just home all day. Do you have any friends at all?"
His father has said things like this for years. But at this moment, Nath feels something snap, like an overstretched wire.
"None. I'm not like you. No conferences, no meetings."
He wrinkles his nose.
"You smell like perfume. From your meetings, I guess?"
James grabs him by the shoulder, so hard his knuckles crack.
"Don't you talk to me that way," he says. "Don't you question me. You don't know anything about my life."
Then before he even realizes the words are forming, they shoot from his mouth like spit.
"Just like you didn't know anything about your sisters."
Nath's expression doesn't change, but his whole face stiffens, like a mask. James wants to snatch the words back out of the air like moths, but they've already crawled into his son's ears. He can see it in Nath's eyes, which have gone shiny and hard as glass. He wants to reach out and touch his son, his hand, his shoulder, anywhere, and tell him he didn't mean it, that none of this is his fault. Then Nath punches the countertop so hard it leaves a crack in the old worn laminate. He runs out of the room, footsteps thundering up the stairs, and James lets his bag fall to the floor and slumps back against the counter. His hand touches something cold and wet, the crushed remains of the hard-boiled egg, shards of shell driven deep into the tender white. All night he thinks about this, his son's frozen face, and the next morning he rises early. Retrieving the newspaper from the front porch, he sees the date black and stark in the corner. July 3rd. 2 months to the day since Lydia disappeared. It doesn't seem possible that just 2 months ago he had sat in his office grading papers, that he had been embarrassed to pluck a ladybug from Louisa's hair. Until 2 months ago, July 3rd had been a happy date, secretly treasured for 10 years, the day of Marilyn's miraculous return. How everything has changed. In the kitchen, James slides the rubber band from the newspaper and unrolls it. There, below the fold, he sees a small headline. Teacher and classmates remember departed girl. The articles about Lydia have grown shorter and sparser. Soon they would stop entirely, and everyone would forget about her. James cups the paper toward him. The day is cloudy, but he leaves the light off, as if the dimness will soften what he's about to read. From Karen Adler. "She seemed lonely. She didn't really hang out with anyone." From Pam Saunders. "She didn't have a lot of friends, or even a boyfriend. I don't think the boys even noticed her." At the bottom, Lee's physics teacher, Donald Kelly, remembered her as the lone sophomore in a class of juniors, noting, "She worked hard, but of course she stood out." Beside the article, a sidebar. "Children of mixed backgrounds often struggle to find their place." Then the telephone rings. Every time, his first thought is, "They've found her." In that instant, a tiny part of him shouts that it's all a mix-up, a case of mistaken identity, a bad dream. Then the rest of him, which knows better, pulls him down with a sickening thud. "You saw her." And he remembers again, with awful clarity, her swollen hands, her pale and waxen face. It is because of this that his voice, when he answers the phone, always trembles.
Mr. Lee?
It's Officer Fisk.
I hope it's not too early to call. How are you this morning?
Fine, James says. Everyone asks this, and by now it is an automatic lie.
Well, Mr. Lee,
Officer Fisk says, and James knows now it is bad news. No one called you by name so insistently unless they were trying to be kind.
I'm calling to let you know that we've decided to close our investigation. We are ruling this case a suicide.
James has to repeat these words to himself before he understands.
Suicide?
Officer Fisk pauses.
Nothing in police work is ever sure, Mr. Lee. I wish it were. It's not like the movies. Things are hardly ever clear-cut.
He does not like breaking bad news, and he takes refuge in official language.
Circumstances suggest suicide is by far the most likely scenario. No evidence of foul play, a history of loneliness, her grades were slipping, going out on the lake when she knew she couldn't swim.
James bows his head, and Officer Fisk continues. His tone is gentler now, like a father consoling a young child.
We know this isn't easy for you and your family, Mr. Lee. We hope this at least helps you move on.
Thank you, James says. He sets the receiver back on its hook. Behind him, Marilyn hovers in the doorway, one hand on the jamb.
Who was it?
She asks. By the way she clutches her robe tight over her heart, James knows she's already heard everything. She flicks the light switch, and in the sudden brightness he feels exposed and raw.
They can't close the case, Marilyn says. Whoever did this is still out there.
Whoever did this? The police think...
James pauses.
They don't think there was anyone else involved.
They don't know her. Someone must have taken her out there. Lured her.
Marilyn hesitates, the cigarettes and condoms surfacing in her mind. But anger muscles them aside and turns her voice shrill.
She wouldn't have gone out there by herself. Do you think I don't know my own daughter?
James does not reply. All he can think is,
if we'd never moved here, if she had never seen the lake.
The silence between them thickens, like ice, and Marilyn shivers.
You believe them, don't you? She says. You think she did this thing?
She cannot bring herself to use the word suicide. The mere thought of it sets her aboil again.
Lydia would never do such a thing to her family, to her mother. How could James believe it?
They just want to close the case.
Easier to stop looking than to do any real work.
Marilyn's voice quivers, and she clenches her hands, as if stilling them will still the trembling inside her.
If she were a white girl, they'd keep looking.
A rock plummets into James's gut. In all their time together, white has been only the color of paper, of snow, of sugar. Chinese, if it is mentioned at all, is a kind of checkers, a kind of fire drill, a kind of takeout, one James doesn't care for. It did not bear discussion any more than that the sky was up or that the earth circled the sun. He had naively thought that, unlike with Marilyn's mother, unlike with everyone else, this thing made no difference to them. Now, when Marilyn says this, if she were a white girl, it proves what James has feared all along, that inside, all along, she'd labeled everything,
white and not white. That this thing makes all the difference in the world.
If she were a white girl, he says, none of this would ever have happened.
Marilyn, still fuming at the police, does not understand, and her confusion makes her angrier.
What do you mean?
Under the kitchen light, her wrists are pale and thin, her lips set, her face cold. James remembers. Long ago, when they were young and the worst thing they could imagine was not being together, he had once leaned in to touch her, and his fingertips had left a trail of goosebumps across her shoulder blade. Every tiny hair on his arm had stood up, electrified. That moment, that connection seems far away and small now, like something that happened in another life.
You know what I mean. If she'd been a white girl...
The words are ash bitter on his tongue.
If she'd been a white girl, if I'd been a white man, she would have fit in.
For moving would never have been enough. He sees that now. It would have been the same anywhere. Children of mixed backgrounds often struggle to find their place. The mistake was earlier, deeper, more fundamental. It had happened the morning they'd married, when the justice of the peace had looked at Marilyn and she had said yes. Or earlier, on that first afternoon they'd spent together, when he had stood beside the bed, naked and shy, and she had twined her legs around his waist and pulled him toward her. Earlier yet, on that first day when she'd leaned across his desk and kissed him, knocking the breath out of him like a swift, sharp punch. A million little chances to change the future. They should never have married. He should never have touched her. She should have turned around, stepped out of his office into the hallway, walked away. He sees with utter clarity. None of this was supposed to happen. A mistake.
Your mother was right after all, he says. You should have married someone more like you.
Before Marilyn can say anything, before she knows whether to be angry or sad or hurt, before she really understands what James has said, he is gone. This time, he does not bother to stop at the college. He drives straight to Louisa's, speeding through every traffic light, arriving out of breath, as though he'd run there on foot. Is everything all right? She says when she opens the door, still smelling of the shower, dressed but wet-haired, hairbrush in hand. I didn't expect you so early. It's only 9:15. And James hears the questions that ripple behind her surprise. Has he come to stay? What about his wife? He does not know the answers. Now that he has finally pushed those words out into the air, he feels strangely light. The room wobbles and spins, and he sinks down onto the sofa. You need to eat something, Louisa says. She steps into the kitchen and returns with a small Tupperware. Here. Gently, she pries open the lid and nudges the box toward him. Inside lie 3 snow-colored buns, tops ruffled like peony heads ready to blossom, revealing a glint of deep tawny red within. The sweet scent of roast pork wafts up to his nose. I made them yesterday, Louisa says. She pauses. You know what these are? His mother had made these, long ago, in their tiny cinder-colored apartment. She had roasted the pork and crimped the dough and arranged the buns in the bamboo steamer she'd brought all the way from China. His father's favorite, chashubao. Louisa beams. And only then does James realize he has spoken aloud. He has not said a word in Chinese in 40 years. but he is amazed at how his tongue still curls around their familiar shape.